So yesterday, we briefly went back to the issue of chemical potential, which we saw a few lectures before, and we discussed why the chemical potential of photon gas or thermal radiation is zero. Similarly, phonon gas in the case of solid, because those excitations are not conserved. Either the medium, particles in the medium or in the heat bath can emit photons and they can absorb photons or phonons. So in the grand canonical ensemble picture, we keep the chemical potential zero and the system decides the number of mean number of phonons based on just energy and entropy consideration. Then we went back to Bose-Einstein condensation and fermions, and we showed by looking at the equation that determines chemical potential, namely total number of given particle is equal to sum over all occupied states. So if you look at that equation carefully, we found that at very high temperature, there is no difference between fermions and bosons and Boltzmann gas. All the chemical potential is large and negative. Then I pointed out that this is what we saw. For bosons, you have this chemical potential as a function of temperature, and then it vanishes at a particular point. And if you do the same thing for fermions, it does vanish, but it keeps marching up. And this is for fermion. This is for boson. And this is related to post-condensation, and this is related to Fermi-C formation. So this is what is discussed. And after this, I wanted to do some exact statistical mechanics, the famous Ansager solution of Ising model. And if you read Ansager's paper, it's mathematically somewhat long and complicated. Using similar ideas, like same ideas Ansager had, Leib, Schulz, Matisse, and many others have solved Ising model problem in a more friendly way. So I started describing that yesterday. So in the process, I introduced the idea of transfer matrix, which already you know from one-dimensional Ising model. This transfer matrix becomes somewhat bigger in a two-dimensional Ising model, and it becomes an operator. And that operator looks like exponential of a Hamiltonian, where the Hamiltonian is so-called quantum spin chain. So I came up to that. And on the way, I said that Jordan-Wigner transformation is very important and handy. So I will do that. But before I do that, based on some discussions I had with David and others, I will step back a little bit and review mean field theory that we did. It turned out I did everything in half a class, mean field theory plus calculation of correlation functions. And I will do it in some detail, trying to focus on the physics behind it. So there are many approaches to understanding mean field theory. Yesterday, in the last class, I pointed out how to get mean field theory using a self-consistent approach. So that is one approach, very well respected approach. But it turns out, when you come to more complicated problems, these arguments may become a little more complicated. So there is a variational approach. Like in many body, in quantum mechanics, you want to solve ground state energy of some interacting system. Exact solution is often a luxury. You can do it for harmonic oscillator. You can do it for hydrogen atom. Even when you consider helium atom, where there are two electrons seeing a nuclear charge, exact solution doesn't exist. So it is here in real quantum mechanics, day-to-day life in quantum mechanics, we have so-called variational approximation. That is, you put all the physical input and then write down a wave function, which you imagine is the best variational wave function to describe the physics of the system. And these wave functions have some few parameters. And fortunately, there is a variational principle in quantum mechanics that if you take such a variational state and compute optimal energy within this variational wave function by changing the parameter and finding their optimal values, you find that you get energies which are bounded from below. That is, you can confidently say that the energy you calculate is more than the ground state energy. Already, this kind of variational approaches are very, very powerful in understanding many body problem and quantum systems, because after all, we are not interested in exact solutions and exact understanding. So we are interested in finding key phenomena that are going on and new concepts that emerge. We want to understand them sharply. So their variational approach is extremely helpful, and it can take a long way. So that is one approach. Another approach is to study toy model systems, which may look artificial, but at the end of the day, you can solve the model system exactly and get your dear mean field theory out of it. So that is what I will do today, because I thought it's a good illustration of a well-known model called infinite range interaction model, which is very popular in condensed matter context in several places. In fact, in some situations, they are even real, in the sense they are very useful models. So here you assume that you have spins, you can put it on a lattice. In the normal physical system, nearest neighbor spin alone will interact. And if you consider two spins separated by long distance, interactions would be exponentially small. So ignore them. So you do what is called nearest neighbor approximation, which is what you did in a Ising chain or in two-dimensional square lattice problem. But imagine you have a situation in which every spin is coupled to every other spin. So for example, this could happen if you have a very large coordination number. When you have one dimension, you have two neighbors. When you go to two dimension, you have four neighbors. When you go to three dimension, in a cubic lattice, you have six neighbors. So as you keep going higher to a higher dimension, you'll have infinite number of neighbors. So already you start seeing that the problem should become simpler, because if I have infinite many neighbors, each one will want me to point in some direction. But since there is a large number, I will see some robust mean field and small fluctuations. If I have just two neighbors, I will see very strong fluctuation, and the mean may not have any meaning. So as you go to higher dimension, the mean will start getting meaning. And in fact, it happens in statistical mechanics problem we will see in detail, that when you go to dimension beyond four and above, mean field theory makes lots of sense from the critical point phenomena point of view. So there is a very friendly model which illustrates this aspect very nicely, which is called infinite range Ising model. So as before, every spin is interacting. There is spin-spin interaction, but now every spin is interacting with everybody else. Now we'll immediately will notice there is a problem with respect to energy. If the interaction between two spins is J, the total energy of the system will scale as J times N square, because every spin is interacting with every other spin. Because previously, it was scaling as J times Z, number of nearest neighbors. Now everybody is a neighbor for me. So now, if I think about energy per spin, I divide it by the total number of spin, then I will get some number which is not intensive. It keeps blowing because it becomes J times N. So there is something I have to be careful. In order to get meaningful quantities per spin, what all I have to do is something very simple. I normalize this J by where N is a number of systems. So this is a kind of artificial model where coupling between two spins is very weak. As the system becomes larger and larger, it becomes weaker and weaker. But however, the total effect continues to give me, because I'm J dividing it by N, something of the order of J. So J plays a very important role as a scale, and N becomes a parameter which controls that coupling. So this is called infinite range Ising model, and there are ways of approaching it by starting with cubic lattice in D dimension and making D the dimension infinity. So sometimes it's called infinite dimensional model. Okay. So now we will see, well, evaluate the partition function of this model exactly. Incidentally, this is given in great detail in Kadanoff's book. So we will evaluate the partition function exactly and see that it gives us the mean field theory that we have studied so far. So of course, I will also apply a magnetic field. So as before, the spin variables take two values, plus or minus one. So I have to do the partition sum. My partition function is trace over all spins e to the power of minus theta j by n. Now, I notice that since there is no restriction over summation, I can write it as Si whole square. Because when you expand this, there will be all pairing. And there will be some diagonal term, which is sum over Si square. Since Si is plus or minus 1, it's a constant. So just an additive constant. It's not going to affect my physics. So I will ignore that. So then I have plus, in the convention, I have minus. Spins are happy pointing parallel to the magnetic field. So this is what I want to evaluate this trace. Now I call this as total spin, which is, that is S total, is defined as without normalization, sum over all spin, and minus. So I want to evaluate this. So then I now use a very simple Gaussian trick. This is something very popular when you do many body theory. It has a fancy name called Hubbard Stefanovich identity, but it's a very simple thing. It essentially says that you can replace your Gaussian by using the following identity. Yes? You all know this identity. Yeah, this is basically normalization of a Gaussian, which is 1. You take a Gaussian distribution and find the integrator, it's 1. Now, if you have a Gaussian which is displaced, integral, you can convince yourself, is again 1. Because you are going from minus infinity to plus infinity. This displacement doesn't matter. So now you can expand this. And basically what you will get is, you will get a connection between this Gaussian and the undisplaced Gaussian, which is called the Hubbard-Stefanovich identity. I have it somewhere here. Yes. So when you do that, what you will find is the numerator, what is there in the exponential, this can be expanded in a trivial way. You have x square plus a square minus 2ax. So this term is independent of the variable that I'm integrating with. So I can take it to the right-hand side. So I'll get e to the power of plus a square divided by 2 sigma square. So what is interesting is you have a variable which you are integrating, which is like a Gaussian. So there is a quadratic term and there is a linear term. Both are appearing. By shifting the Gaussian, you can make it look like a simple term like this. This is the idea. Why do we do that? When you do that, this, as you will see, this integration will become very simple. Okay, so far so good. This is simple trick I am doing. So when I do this, when I look at the partition function, it becomes beta j divided by n. Then now I call dt as the dummy variable I have introduced, because that's what I have written in the book. So it is e to the power of minus n by 2 beta j t square. And then I have a trace, of course, standing here of the h beta plus t times s total. So I hope you are with me. What I'm doing is I have this s total square and linear term. I'm just combining them together and make it look like linear s total so that I can do the trace easily. So now I push the trace inside. So everything remains the same. I have trace of minus h beta and this trace is trivial to do because S total is sum over all spin. So I have essentially Boltzmann factor, which is product over all sides. So this gives me the famous 2 to the power of n. Because I have n sides or n spins, I get this. So this is nice because now I have done the trace. Now let me see. Now having done the trace, what all I have is just a one-dimensional integral in terms of this t. Yes? Two. Yeah. These two will be inside, sorry. So yeah, two will be inside. I can pull it out and it's not going to contribute much. Yeah, it's important, right, to keep track of. So now, if I look at this partition function, if I rewrite it, it has become a very simple and nice looking integral of one variable. And what is nice is that this variable has minus and what is interesting is there is an n sitting here. One of the n came from the normalization factor of j, and another came from the number of spins. So this is an integral in which I have a large n sitting here. And you all know that you can do so-called saddle point approximations whenever you have integrals like this with a large n here. Because essentially, what this integration is going to do is it's going to essentially pick up contribution as you do this integral in the t-axis over a region where this is maximum. And then only from the neighborhood. The rest will be exponentially small. So this is the spirit of so-called saddle point approximation. So before I do that, what I will do is I will rewrite this in a friendly way, which gives me immediately, I'll change the note, basically I'll have to just change the notation Yes. Just it involves scaling of this t variable. But then that is what I do is I replace t by beta j. I could have done it earlier, but by a new variable called m, which will become our friendly magnetization variable. And then what you have is you have, I'm just simply scaling this t by this, d e to the power of minus n j times m square, because I have scaled it, minus kt log cosh this is nice because this starts looking like free energy because this contains information about interaction between spins, two spins. So the mean value of that energy is magnetization square, and this looks like entropy. So in some sense, this starts looking like a free energy corresponding to some magnetization. So it is as if I am evaluating an integral So it is as if I am evaluating an integral in which there is times capital N, where I can call this a small f, saying free energy per spin. So in a very natural way, my sum over spins has given me a collective variable, namely magnetization, which we normally look for. Here, because of the infinite range interaction, just that variable appears, nothing else. There are no fluctuations. So now you can find, you can evaluate this integral asymptotically exactly simply by looking at the saddle point. That is, by taking first derivative with respect to m. And that immediately gives you the famous equation that we have seen before. Because when you take derivative with respect to log, cosh will come down and sine hyperbolic will come above, then you'll have everything. Finally, you'll have beta h plus j times m. So last time I motivated this equation by saying that there is a spin which is seeing some self-consistent field from the neighbors. And then we don't know what it is. And then we assume that it is there. And then we take that as our effective Hamiltonian. And then calculate the expectation value of spin. And then we equate the two. And you get this self-consistent equation. Here, I didn't do anything like that. I said that spins are interacting among themselves. All spins are interacting among themselves. And then they did some little mathematics. At the end of the day, I have an integration over only one collective variable, namely average magnetization, nothing else. This you could have anticipated from the beginning because in some sense there is a symmetry in the problem, that is every spin, the distance between every spin is identical. So there is nothing like a fluctuation. So if anything fluctuates, it is the total magnetization that will fluctuate. And its fluctuation is controlled by the total number of spins. So this is a very nice theory. This is called a mean field theory now. So in a sense, mean field theory gives exact results for this problem. Because I can step back and say that, OK, I won't do any of these integrations. And I will argue that I have a spin, and I have infinite number of neighbors. So they offer a mean field for me. And that mean field is going to become more and more sharp with less and less fluctuation as n becomes larger and larger. So I could give mean field argument and directly write down that self-consistent equation. Instead, I did little mathematics and got this. So this is the spirit of mean field theory. But now you also notice that in this exact model, only one variable, one collective variable, namely total magnetization, is important. Nothing else is important. Now, when you start making this J position dependent, that is, that you say that like in 2D IC model, you say only neighbors interact. In addition to these collective variables, there are variables which have shorter wavelength. You can think of this collective variable as a variable corresponding to collective motion of all the spins. So in some sense, that has zero wave vector or infinite wavelength. But when you really look at a spin system, there will be fluctuations at all wavelength scale. So this mean field theory completely ignores fluctuations at length scale shorter than the size of the system. But still, it works remarkably well. So all the things that we will do from now on is how to go beyond and how to include fluctuations in systematic fashion. And in fact, renormalization group approach, which we will do shortly from tomorrow onwards, gives you a way of handling fluctuations which are in plenty. Because you have fluctuations depending on where you are. Suppose you are well in the ordered state, fluctuations are very small. It is dominated by a large order, long range order and magnetization. But as you approach the critical point, as we know, that fluctuations at all length scales start coming in and the problem becomes hard. And the renormalization group, as we will see, is a systematic way of getting friendly with the fluctuations and understanding them and making a progress and getting fixed. Yes? Sorry?
There's some algebra errors in this derivation.
I'm sure there are errors. Yeah, okay. See, I am very myopic to pi's and 2's and so on. I should correct myself next. What is there? Please tell me. Where is Yeah, right. It should not. Yeah, this is important. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So now we understand the meaning of the self-consistent equation that we wrote down. Now I will do correlation functions, which I did last time. Again, I rushed through very fast. So today I will try to do it a little slower. Let us see. And because I think it's good to understand mean field theory as well as possible. In the next class, I mentioned about this variational approach in quantum mechanics. So there is a similar approach in statistical mechanics. That is, the Boltzmann distribution function you have is very complicated to deal with unless you have simple situation like this. So what you do is you replace it by something which you can handle with some parameters hidden there. And then you optimize your free energy. I will do that in detail later and get some insight. And the free energy you get is always bounded from below. That means it's not an uncontrolled approximation. You know the free energy you got is slightly larger than the real value. Depending on the problem, it can be 10% larger or 1% larger. More importantly, this kind of approach gives you existence of phases very nicely. What kinds of phases exist? You have a ferromagnet, you have a paramagnet. In detail, the critical behavior may be lost. But it gives you possible phases. And when you explore new phases, these mean field theories are extremely important. They are real guides. OK. Now let me do correlation functions. So we are interested in calculating now we use the symbol M for magnetization per spin. Thermodynamic average. So this is called correlation function. I will use the notation Gij. That is a correlation between two spins, spin I and spin J at the site, and the distance is some Rij. So we are interested in calculating this average. You can ask this question, can I calculate this average in the model that I had before? The answer is yes, you can calculate it. But in that model, there is no spatial metric. Because since every spin is connected to every other spin, there is nothing like a space. You can say it's infinite dimensional space. So the distance is not very well defined. It doesn't relate to our one dimension or two dimension. So you can calculate such quantities, but they are not very meaningful. So we will actually do not go to that model now, but we will go to our mean field theory, which we have understood now, self-consistency equation, and see what best we can do from there. This is what I did last time. So there, basically, my equation that I wrote down last time was mi So you notice that in the previous cases, what I had was, last time what I did, I had m equals tan hyperbolic beta j, m times number of neighbors plus h beta. Because I assumed that I have a translation invariant system. The field that I have applied is uniform. So the self-consistent field that any spin sees will be the same. So I made an assumption, so I had no index. Now, since I want to talk about correlation functions of two spins separated by some distance, somehow the spatial information has to come in the analysis. So what I do is I say that I have now a very general self-consistent equation. The only difference is that the self-consistent field is position dependent. And also I have put by hand external magnetic field, which is position dependent. And finally, I'm going to take derivative with respect to this magnetic field and make it 0. So there is nothing more very complicated in doing it in this general fashion. Okay? So this is the same self-consistent equation that I derived before, assuming that a spin at site I sees mean field from its neighbor, which could be in general different. And then I have also a local external magnetic field, which could be in general different. Now, as I also pointed out that suppose you take this quantity, this will give you, that is, if you manage to calculate self-consistently the magnetization at a given site, in general, it's a function of all parameters, including MIs and HIs. So if you take the derivative with respect to H, J, beta, it will basically, in the expression for this, will contain e to the power of the Boltzmann factor. It will bring down that particular S below, that is Sj. So you'll have, so this is like, you know, having a source and then taking derivative with respect to that source, and then getting this equation. So now we make another simplification. I think I rushed through these things last time first. When you are close to the critical point, you don't need to play with tan hyperbolic function, because tan hyperbolic function is very nonlinear. So as we saw yesterday, the tan hyperbolic function has this behavior. It is very linear, close to origin, and then it starts deviating. The leading deviation is minus x cube by 3. So since we are dealing with phenomena close to critical point, so we will approximate this curve by the following. That is, we say that tan x 1 minus. So it turns out to be a very good approximation, which gives you, yes. Oh, yeah, thank you. Very important. So there is a linear term, and then it starts deviating minus x cube by 3. OK, so then this is equation becomes simple. So the leading term beta j So there is a magnetic field term. M of neighbors, delta is a, says there are so many neighbors, plus the cubic term here. I neglect the external magnetic field term because already it's a small field. I will have cube of that and higher power, so I ignore that. So this is an approximation. Now it is this which is going to give me a formal expression for correlation function. So what I did was I took derivative of this with respect to beta hi. Then you get Si plus j correlation function, which is called gij. So I will get a delta function here because this is site I. I'm taking derivative with respect to site j. Then this will become beta j g I I plus delta summation over delta plus. Now here I am going to again make approximations. I will assume that within my neighbors, the magnetization is not going to change very much. So I will replace this by beta j times z q times m I cube. And when I take derivative of that, it will give me basically the same thing that I had before, m square times g I j. Putting gij subscripts and superscripts, sorry about that. So it's very nice equation. So this tells about spin correlation between two sites I and j. This is local. This is slightly non-local. It says that this quantity is related to the spin correlation between two neighboring sites. And then it's also related to between two sites with this factor. Yes. Sorry, here? Exactly. So what, yeah. So this j I I plus delta is equal to d by d beta h j of this quantity. So m I plus delta. This is the definition. Now this m is going to depend on j. Because see, when, if you look at this equation, I have not solved this equation. This equation is a very special equation for every site. So in general, the solutions will depend on the local magnetic field because it's like set of nonlinear coupled equations. So when I solve it, it's going to depend on all Hs. And in 1 minute. So similarly, this m that I get is also going to depend on. So when I take derivative of this with respect to this, by definition, this will get me correlation of Si and Si plus delta. I have not done any calculation.
No, I'm just saying like it's a notational
J is constant. J is not varying spatially. Only H is varying. Oh yeah, sorry, this index j, correct. So it is an orbit because I have a lattice in which there are so many points. In particular, now this is a simple cubic lattice or a square lattice. So the index j picks up an arbitrary point from this lattice. And that is the meaning of this derivative. Sorry, let me clear. Is that clear? Good. So you know what I mean. We'll come back to it. Yeah.
Yeah, my question was similar. You've written J within this is I and I plus delta, should it be J G? So within this is J.
So. Sorry. So I'm Probably, is that the question? Oh, I'm very sorry. Again, for a sloppy notation. So this should be. Exactly, yeah. Right. Thank you. So, yeah. So I'm looking at spin correlation function between I and J side. This equation connects that with one of the neighbors, for example, which is J plus delta X. So it says that this spin correlation function is related to this spin correlation function, which is this. Sorry, yeah, it's the notation. I didn't look at it carefully. Yeah, it is this. Let's see, how do I correct it now? J, right. This is correct, yeah. Was that your question? Okay. There was a question behind? Okay. Yes.
Could you repeat how you write the third term?
This term?
Yeah, how you.
Oh, okay. Hey, that's good. So let us look at it. I have three, all the magnetization, self-consistent field coming from the neighbors. And I know that eventually I'm going to make H vanish at every site. So I'm like probing it with a small external spatial. So I make an assumption that this M is going to depend only on the site I, not on the neighbor. That is, it's very similar when I look at it I as well as the neighbors. Otherwise, I'm assuming some correlation among the solution that I anticipate. So I replace this mi plus delta by mi. And its derivative gives me gij. So that's an assumption. This is a well-stated assumption. Then we can check whether it's meaningful by looking at the result.
So you have among those three.
Yes.
Exactly.
Let's see. I have a square lattice, I have 4m. So as far as this term is concerned, see, in this term I was very careful because this term also connect neighbors. So it turns out this is a leading term in which I should be careful about this delta dependence. Whereas here, there are corrections coming from what you are saying, but you can do further analysis and show that they are less important than this. So this is assumption because already I have thrown many terms. So now I have an approximate expression. Here I make further analysis just to give me a closed equation which is asymptotically correct. Okay. So sorry about this mess, but this is this correct? Indices are this equation. Oh, yeah, right. So there is a minus sign. Yeah, thank you. Very important.
And even the 3 will go, right?
Sorry?
The derivative. Even the 3 will disappear, right, with the derivative?
Right, yeah. M cube, yeah, 3 will disappear. Yeah, thank you. So I think this is called renormalization. Slowly I'm reaching the correct equation. So this is our equation. Now, if you look at it, this is an equation for a two-point function. So a two-point function is basically connected to the same two-point function times two-point functions that connects two neighbors of the site I. And now I make the assumption that magnetic field vanish. So because particularly after I took derivative, and after I made all those approximations, there is no explicit magnetic field here. Okay? So I can now calculate solution of this. Now I can make use of translation invariance. That is, if I choose two sites I and j and keep the separation vector the same and move everywhere, nothing will happen, should change. So that tells me that I can use Fourier transformation to solve this problem. This is all something that you are all very familiar. There again, I had many, many. So now when you Fourier transform, it's very okay. So GK. So I'm defining a Fourier transform of GAJ with in terms of this GK. Now when you our inverse Fourier transform will contain summation over all I and J. This is a formal definition of Fourier transformation. Now I take that equation and do this. The first term will give me simply a g of k. And the delta function, as you can imagine, will give me some 1 because it will vanish. Gij is delta ij, so rij vanishes. So I get some number which you can normalize it to be 1. Then this is the interesting part. When you write this and do Fourier transformation, there is an extra term now coming from this Rij dependence, which will come as e to the power of ik times neighbors. So plus some number which is e to the power of minus ik coming from the neighbor on the opposite side. So this is a neighbor delta, and this is minus delta x. So it is this which gives you a cosine factor. So you will have beta j, which is cosine k alpha times a is the lattice parameter when you do it in the proper units. So you have g of k, where alpha runs from 1 to d. So if I am in 2-dimension, I have summed over x direction and minus x direction. That gives me 2 cosine k, so there will be a factor of 2. Similarly, other directions. So this is what you get. So the equation in momentum space has a very nice, very important point. But it is this which tells you about propagation. That is, there is a term which depends on k through this cosine k. And the last term is g of k. It's independent of k. So it is this when you rewrite. I wrote it in the last time. So you can essentially rewrite these things as plus some constant term. And there are 2 constant terms coming. One is coming from this, and another coming from the cubic term that we had. So without falling into the trap of missing 2s and so on, this is fairly straightforward, that what you find is that this term contains the average value of spin square plus t minus tc, which we will call as epsilon. You also have g of k. Yeah, because when you do Fourier transformation, the g, j, and I plus delta becomes g of k multiplied by a form factor. So this is a power of Fourier transformation. OK, so let me do this. So let me say I want to do, let me take a very simple example. I want to Fourier, OK. I want to Fourier transform this. R J let me take to be in the direction, okay, as a vector, okay? This is what you want to do. Now, you know that, now you can separate this out. It's sitting there. Now you have two independent summation. One is a summation over I and another is a summation over j. And also, when you really do the Fourier transformation, you will have k e to the power of I k prime or j minus time, let's say, k prime. Now, when you sum over this ri minus rj, you will get delta k k prime. And then when you sum over this delta, you get the cosine factor. Please do it. You know, this is straightforward. You will come across this in several times when you do analysis. Just go back to this definition of Fourier transformation. That is, I Fourier transform with respect to this site I and site j. So that means I have e to the power of I k R I e to the power of I k or j. So in general, there are two k. And then when I sum over this site I, and they get connected, and you get a delta function, you get this. Is that clear? Okay. Yes. No, there are two terms. So there is a one I have added here and subtract. In fact, this one, if you remember, is not there. I have added and subtracted. It is that combination which gives me t minus tc. And then this term comes from the last one. Exactly. So tc, I kbtc is equal to j times coordination number. Or in this case, 2D. I have assumed this. Now is the thing that I was mentioning, that you have an integration over Brillouin zone. Now, this summation is over k, allowed values of k for a square lattice, for example, will be a square Brillouin zone. But you know that when you are, since you are being close to TC, this integral will be singular, you know, for if it is 0, it goes as 1 over k square. So when you do the Fourier transformation, when you look at gij, it's going to be dominated by physics at small k, or you are looking at long distances. So it is sufficient if you make a small k approximation, and that is what gave, last time I pointed out, when you expand cosine, it's 1 minus k square, kx square plus ky square and so on. So that adds up to give you k square. And all these things add up to give you an m square, which is like the mass, which now depends on t and the magnetization plus k square. And then g of r, where if r is the distance between two points, is e to the power of I k dot. So the g of r for long distances will be well approximated by expanding this cosine and having this. So I pointed out this looks like a propagator, a boson propagator in field theory, and you are Fourier transforming that. And in particular, I pointed out that when this mass term is 0, which happens if you sit at TC, this t minus TC is 0, and the self-consistent value of order parameter is also 0, you have a very nice integral divided by k square. Now you can talk about asymptotic behavior for large r simply by scaling argument, because the Brillouin zone boundary, when you scale it, will go up to infinity. So you have essentially an integral which is like this. You can do radial in all volume integral in K space, and then you are left with KD minus 1 dk times some number which talks about angular integrations. So if you now replace K of R by some variable x, then you can pull out the R dependence basically, and that will give you something, some G naught, which depends on some simple quantities like dimension, times 1 over R to the power of D minus 2. This is what I pointed out. Just a simple scale dimension analysis of this integral extracts an R dependence, which is very good for very large separation. So you say at the critical point, within this mean field analysis, the correlation function decays in a power law fashion. There is a scale invariance. And then I said that things like quantum corrections in the language of quantum field theory will lead to anomalous dimension. So, okay. So this is in some, whatever I have done is supposed to be a review of what I did. Yes.
So what is again the physical meaning of the mass M?
How far I am away from the critical point. So it's very clear when I come from above TC. When I come from above TC, my magnetization, suppose I approach along this line, then the only parameter is T minus TC. Or to be precise, a dimensionless thing, which is 1 minus TC by T. So this is the mass, dimensionless mass. So because it also gives you a length scale. So in quantum field theory, the mass gets translated, you know, when you come to statistical mechanics in terms of length scale. Because we are, it's like an Euclidean quantum field theory. So, yeah.
So the propagating degree of freedom is instead of bosonic.
Exactly. So propagating degree of freedom, if you go back and analyze, for example, that it's a Gaussian fluctuation of scalar variable. So in a manner of speaking, they are like bosonic fluctuations. So if you think about it as an Euclidean path integral, whatever you are doing as some quantum problem, the fluctuations are bosonic. Right. So, okay, that's a good question. So here, I intuitively said that this is like the free energy. So let me, yeah, that's a good question. So maybe I will answer that. So if I look at this free energy, you can, I will do it in some detail later. If you expand log cosh, you get a term. So this remains one of field theory where you have d phi . So in a quantum field theory, your action has this form. There is some scalar variable which feels the gradient, spatial variation. And then you have a mass term. Now, if I expand it in powers of this order parameter, this is what I get, my F free energy. So the only thing missing here is this derivative term, because I have taken infinite range interaction. So this is how it gets the name, meaning mass term. That is the, M is order parameter or magnetization, and the deviation from critical point is a mass term. And that's the way it appears here also. And lambda, so if I plot this free energy, it has a famous form that above transition temperature, it is dominated by this positive mass term. So it is quadratic. So this makes it, pulls it up at higher m. Now, at the critical point, it is simply m to the power of, so it becomes flatter here. Then below the critical point, for short m value, this dominates. So you have a curve which is going down and then it's pulled back again. So this is what happens in quantum field theory. So if you have a complex phi, and then this will be the Higgs Mexican hat and so on. We will come to those things in detail. So you are, I suppose your question is clear. Is the answer clear? Okay. Yeah. Exactly. Read off correlation from here. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, in particular, the correlation, when you, so here I evaluated it at the critical point because I put the mass term. So I can move away from critical point and do similar asymptotic analysis. It will give me an exponential dependence on Ri minus Rj with something which is like, so this is the correlation. That means within this theory, we'll find correlation length diverging as Tc minus T. So there's a dimensionless. Sorry? Yeah. So if I'm below Tc, I will subtract this magnetization part. And I'll look at fluctuations about the mean value. And that fluctuation about the mean value is exponentially decaying when you are away from the point, and that is characterized by a length which is going like this.
And the other question is that here this magnetization actually scales one half. It's pretty close.
Exactly. It's very easy to see. So basically, I have to look at what is the minimum. So I minimize this, and suppose I minimize it, I will get m. T minus Tc plus lambda m cube. So this gives me T minus Tc is equal to below Tc. So it will become negative 4 lambda square m square. So that means m is equal to
Master, like overall master will also scale
at exactly. That's a very good point. That is related to what is called scaling hypothesis, which was proposed by Widom and so on. That's the next point I wanted to point out. So your observation that two things are related essentially tells that within this analysis, mean field analysis I have performed, I can go close to the critical point, and I have three variables, order parameter, T minus Tc, and magnetic field. And I can get rid of one variable just from this mean field analysis. And this is going to, this is called scaling. OK, let me finish with that. So OK, I suppose I have given you some feeling for the spin-spin correlation function. And there, asymptotically, it has this behavior. And then the correlation length has this particular behavior. And you can proceed further and also calculate susceptibility. It also follows from this equation that m is equal to h plus j beta. So if you solve this equation, you get m as h divided by basically t minus tc. So this is magnetization. For a given magnetic field. I have applied a magnetic field and it induces it. Now I take the derivative of this magnetization with respect to magnetic field. That is so-called susceptibility. That will give me 1 by T minus Tc. So just from linearized self-consistent equation, we can already get another exponent, namely how the tendency to form spontaneous magnetization becomes larger and larger as you approach Tc from above. So this is another divergence. So mean field theory already gives you the mass term or the how correlation length diverges, how susceptibility diverges, and how magnetization vanishes as square root of there is something wrong here. It's not in the denominator, it's in the numerator. I'm glad I found it out. Just, you know, you can see, yeah, M is equal to square root of. Okay. Now let me finish my talk today with some description of scaling. And I think today I will not be able to touch Ansager's solution. Okay. So this is the last thing. So I go back to the mean field equation that we love and then rewrite it. So I have basically, you know, rewritten what I had before, m equal to tan hyperbolic m in terms of this tc and deviation from tc. Now, Kadanoff in the discussion observes that you can define, call this as epsilon. Then this epsilon, you can further define it as, so for example, epsilon minus divided by modulus of epsilon will be plus or minus 1, depending on whether you are above TC or below TC. So let me focus on situations above TC. Then it now divide throughout this entire equation by epsilon to the power of 3/2. Then what you get is you have m divided by epsilon to the power of 1/2 equal to beta h divided by epsilon to the power of 3/2 minus some constant, that is beta j, j and so on, q times m divided by epsilon to the power of 3/2. So I have got an untrivial equation if you look at it, because what I did was I took this original equation and scaled it with respect to deviation from critical point, because you remember epsilon is 1 over 1 minus tc over t, deviation from the critical point. Then now I have a new variable which I can call it as m, which is m divided by, and then another variable capital H, which is external field divided by epsilon to the power of 3/2. So in terms of this new variable, my equation of state becomes very simple, is equal to h minus divided by 3 by putting some of these things into constant. So this is called scaling or inverse, which means that I can look at magnetization behavior of a ferromagnet, kind of, let's say some ion system or some other ferromagnet with a very different TC. If I go sufficiently close to transition temperature, I can define a scale parameter, which is deviation from the critical point, and then I get an equation of state, which is universal. So in a sense, I have gotten rid of one variable. I had three variables, magnetization, magnetic field, and temperature, deviation from critical point, and I scale everything in terms of this. Now, we will do this a little more carefully in the next class, and that will lead to what is called Ben-Widom's scaling hypothesis. Scaling hypothesis. It turns out that you just basically mean field insights gives you behavior of singular part of the free energy. I did not mention it before because all the while I'm talking about free energy, and then something is going to zero, something is diverging, So that there may be some singularity at the critical point, a mathematical singularity of the free energy function. So there is a singular part and there is a non-singular part. So all the statement about the scaling is about the singular part. And then what is remarkable is that this scaling will tell you that the critical exponents that we have been discussing before, like anomalous dimension or magnetization exponent or susceptibility exponent, they are all not independent. They are connected by what is called scaling laws. There is, for example, if I remember correctly, there is one relation like this. Alpha is a specific heat exponent, beta is a magnetization exponent, gamma is probably, I don't remember. So there is some relation among them. Why this is important is that this is the beginning of renormalization group, because Kadanoff looked at this hypothesis and tried to rationalize the entire phenomena as emergence of collective, you know, fluctuations which are growing in size as you approach the TC. So he introduced the idea of block spin hypothesis. And that immediately justified the scaling hypothesis of Widom. And that was a starting point for Wilson's analysis. In fact, Wilson took Kadanoff's block spin hypothesis and did it very formally used for partition functions and did it systematically and introduced notions like fixed point and the whole RG phenomenology. So it was a very big step, but the root was Kadanoff's block spin hypothesis. Okay, I think I will close here today. Any questions? How?
How do you spell it?
How do I spell? Thank you. I can answer this question very well. Leo Kadanoff. Incidentally, you know, Leo comes here often. In fact, a few years ago, he gave statistical mechanics course. So you can see the video, and you know, he.
Does it mean that at this point, like fluctuations propagated by the speed of sound?
Fluctuations?
Propagated the speed of sound in material?
Okay. Yeah, that's a very good point. So far in equilibrium statistical mechanics, I have discussed equilibrium statistical mechanics, there is no notion of dynamics. So it turns out if you go little beyond and input dynamics into this problem through Boltzmann equations or some other way, what you find is there is something called critical slowing down. So your suspicion is fluctuations will propagate with velocity of sound. And in fact, here what happens is it slows down infinitely. So if you create a fluctuations by sitting at the critical point, the characteristic, there is no time scale controlling that fluctuation. So in fact, the temporal fluctuations also become power law. So if you look at, suppose you created a fluctuation here, and then see how it has disappeared after some time, that disappearance is governed by some 1 over q to the power of z, where z is something called some exponent. So this is called critical slowing down. That is, things become slow at the critical point, critically slow. So at the critical point, they're infinitely slow. So then it depends on the probing. Suppose you probe the system at the critical point with some frequency. So all this says that the frequency-dependent response may have a power law like this. Suppose you are calculating some quantity B at the critical point, let's say at some long wavelength scale. So you may have some behavior like this. It may behave very slowly or. So in fact, this is a very interesting problem, the structure of fluctuations and how they propagate with time. You know, in fact, this is related to some of the issues people do in conformal field theory and so on, but it's a very important problem. You had a question? Okay. Thank you.